don't stare at Jamie when he's doing the intro.
Look down.
Whatever you do, don't look at Jamie.
Welcome to the Track and Food Podcast. You're listening to episode 10 today. Thank you for joining us. And there's Mick, as always. I'm your host, Jamie Ma. We are very excited to bring for you today two very special guests that we've been very excited to have on for quite some time now. They are two big, prominent producers of beer in the Vancouver and BC community. One comes from Strange Fellows. His name is Nick Black. Hello, Nick.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And the other is Patrick Droz from Good Company Lager. Hello, Patrick.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Very good.
Gentlemen, we are very excited to have you guys on. We want to talk beer. We want to talk about the business that you guys are in, kind of how you guys got started in this, and what's...
And also, our second group chat in a row.
Yes, so yes.
Thank yous for coming on. Absolutely. I think we found a formula that's working. Episode 10.
We made it to episode 10. If this is your first time listening to us, we are found on iTunes and on Stitcher. You can subscribe to us there. Please rate us if you are enjoying everything that you've listened to so far. Episode 9, we released last week. We brought on Max Borman from Juniper and we brought on Mike Shum from the Fairmont Pacific Rim. We had a great chat about the Vancouver dining community, things that are going on in the city.
Brunch. Again.
Brunch.
Why do we always fucking talk about brunch? I never want to talk about brunch on this podcast again.
Do you guys like brunch?
People love brunch. Yeah. It's like the easiest one to like, I'm going to go for brunch.
I'm not a brunch guy at all.
Yeah, so that was the thing.
I like dim sum. Dim sum's great.
Okay.
That's kind of like for brunch. A brunch in a way.
It is. Yeah, yeah.
Chinese brunch.
Yeah, Chinese brunch, yeah.
Brunch? I don't know.
We're not going down this. Keep going.
Yeah, so we did this last time. Right?
This is a rabbit hole. The brunch rabbit hole.
It's like one of those hot button topics. Just say the word brunch and everyone's like.
Yeah, but that discussion was a lot of fun and it got a little bit heated between Max and Mike about speakeasies.
Yeah,
but
Mike Shum's a jerk, by the way. Everyone knows that, though.
Do have a listen to that one. But anyways, gentlemen, thanks for joining us. We're drinking some great beer here. You both brought your beers, but yes. Nick, you... The first one we're drinking here, you brought on a new one that was just released yesterday, correct?
That's right, yeah. It's actually the third release of this beer.
Okay.
It's Strange Zems. The first incarnation was the collaboration we did with Modern Times. So it was called Strange Times for Modern Fellows.
Amazing, amazing beer, by the way.
So that's why we renamed it when we re-released it to the Resemblance, because the Modern Times guys didn't come up here to brew it with us.
Okay.
But it is the same beer, same culture. It's a wild saison, so it's got a little bit of tartness to it. And then I brought the other one, which was a previous release of it, just to compare them side by side.
Okay. So anybody out there who maybe doesn't know what a saison is, can you maybe kind of explain what that is?
Yeah. I mean, traditionally, it was brewed in Belgium as like a... You'll frequently hear it called like a farmhouse or a farmhand beer. Okay. It was brewed for workers as I guess, to keep workers happy, usually. You know, at the end of the day, they'll have a saison. You know,
a little lighter, easier drinking.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. Traditionally, it's a little bit lower in percentage. You'll find Northwest Saisons, Saisons North America are typically a little bit higher, somewhere between 5.5, 6.5. This one's 6.2, I believe.
Okay.
But traditionally, it's a little bit lighter. It's usually around 4 to 5%. And it's, brewed to drink at the end of the day, when you're working, also to rehydrate. That's what they're usually lower.
Yeah, alcohol. No, I mean, that's kind of the first thing I'm picking up from this beer just now is I'm really liking the bright acidity that comes from it. So it's very refreshing, but it's also got kind of a nice...
Yes, totally. And thank you. Traditionally, Saisons were meant to be kind of like an everyman beer and that everyone should be able to drink. It should be approachable and that. And I think this one does that definitely.
Every person beer.
Sorry, every...
Yeah, come on, it's 2018.
Thank you, Patty.
We got to be politically correct.
Every person, yeah. Sorry, my bad.
You can't even say politically correct anymore.
I know, I can't even say it properly.
It's also got really nice packaging there, Nick. Does it also come in, besides the 750 mil, what other packaging does it come in?
Just 750s. Yeah, just 750s. It's bottle conditioned, so we can kind of recreate it in kegs, but it's better in the bottles. And what bottle condition means is just that there's a little bit of yeast in every bottle, and that just... it'll continue to condition in the bottle. So, I mean, one of the biggest examples of that would be Sierra Nevada Pale Ale. That's a bottle conditioned beer. So it just
is it really?
Yeah.
Huh. I didn't know that.
And that was basically one of the beers that really started the craft beer
Oh yeah,
for sure, big time. Sierra Nevada's they're huge. It's still one of my favorite beers. I think their pale ale is just killer. I mean, I drink a lot of Talisman these days.
Yes,
as everybody does.
I think everybody does. Yeah,
yeah. It's just amazing what Talisman's done to the market. Yeah. You know, it's like the dream beer for every craft brewer.
One of the first session sort of West Coast pale ales,
I think,
that came out.
Yeah, I think it someone's asked me about this last week. I think it came out at a great time. You know, there had been a lot of IPAs. And that's great, and IPAs definitely still have a very strong hold in the marketplace, and for good reason. I mean, there's a ton of really great IPAs. The nice thing about the Talisman is it's a really nice hoppy option, but not 7%, 6.5%. It's only 4%.
Yeah.
So I think we got pretty lucky that when it came out, people were ready for something a little bit lower, and it's since you've seen a lot more kind of session ales or West Coast pales, whatever you want to call them. Mm-hmm. Which is great, and Talisman seems to be still a staple in that market, which is I'm very proud of and very happy about.
I will say one thing, like working where I work, we sell a huge amount of Talisman.
You guys have it on tap?
Yeah, we have it on tap. Oh. We've had it on tap for years, and we've already discussed that it's a beer that's not coming off. It sells so well, people love it. It's very easy to convince someone who maybe loves a lager or pilsner and is looking for something a little bit different, and you can explain to them that it's only 4%, and it's got a really like nice, smooth flavor, and it's very drinkable on any time of year. And yeah, no, I love it. I mean, you guys pour it at the American. And
Yeah, we definitely pour it at the American Boxcar and the Cobalt. And it was kind of nice, I hate to say this, but like Blue Buck had such a huge reign on the city of Vancouver for such a long time.
It basically took their market.
Well, it didn't take their market. It just challenged them in that, you know, because it's like, it definitely bumped Blue Buck
down
to number two.
Number two.
You know, not saying that Blue Buck is still a huge brand. Like, everyone wants to be a Blue Buck still, right? So,
you know what's funny is that the beer that we had before, the Talisman that we poured at the hotel was Blue Buck.
Blue Buck, yeah.
And we switched it out. So I think that says everything right there.
Nice. I did. I mean, anecdotally, I had an account let me know the other day that that we were outselling Blue Buck. And I mean, that's pretty huge because Blue Buck's been a staple, and it's and for good reason. It's a great beer.
Yeah.
Phillips makes
great beer. We love you, Phillips.
Yeah. No.
Like, but, we do love Phillips.
But yeah, to find out that, you know, we're not even 4 years old yet, and to find out that people have gotten such a hold of that brand is awesome. It's great.
So when you bring that up right there, when you talk about brands, one of the curious things that I would like to maybe discuss with you both is your brands. I think you guys have some of the most iconic Vancouver craft beer brands going on right now. And Patrick, I mean, why don't you discuss us like what you have kind of fashioned here with Good Company? Because I think, I mean, when you look at the can itself, I think it's really an iconic kind of can that you see. It's very unique. It's very eye popping. And I think I think you've fashioned this to me before. You've said it's a lifestyle brand. And I think
it's more than just a lifestyle brand. It definitely started off, you know, we kind of worked on the price point and kind of worked backwards. You know, I own the Cobalt Boxcar American, and I definitely saw a hole in the market when it came to craft beers. And everyone was trying to chase Strange Fellows. Everyone wants to be Strange Fellows. And who doesn't want to be Strange Fellows? And, you know, everyone wants to have the top IPA, the top sessional beer, the top everything. And the market that I felt that was left kind of behind was, you know, the value brand.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of like, and obviously at the Cobalt and American Boxcar, it's like, man, we just like threw a lot of cans over the bar. You know, there's always a friend in the group that just wants the like the 550 can or the 450 can or something.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, and you want to
just a crushable, clean,
crushable beer.
Yeah, beer. You know, with beer prices going up in the market right now, you want to definitely have that value brand to be a craft, local, crushable. Isn't PBR, isn't Caribou, isn't these things, but
and
still
a quality product.
Yeah, exactly. So I worked on the recipe. We started with the price point, and we knew the price point and just the way the package looks is going to be number one and number two on the list. And then we reverse engineered it on the flavor profile, and we worked really hard with a couple of brewmasters, and we were excited. And then once I kind of got everything going, a good friend of mine, Mike Corrali, from Steam Whistle. He was just kind of leaving the beer market, and I hustled him back right in.
Perfect.
So he invested into Good Company. He's an owner, and him and I, you know, we've really tackled the Pacific Northwest market.
Steam Whistle, that's Ontario?
That is.
Or is that San Francisco?
No, Ontario, back east.
I'm thinking of Anchor Steam.
Anchor Steam, yeah.
How do you guys know each other?
He was my Steam Whistle rep for 5 years, and we were like the number one Steam Whistle account for bottles in BC. And we really gave them a shot and just really liked the way, you know, Mike Corelli worked. And, you know, the guy's a gem. He's a professor at Cap College and a super smart guy, biochem and anatomy. And, you know, just love the way his mind worked. And now he's, as a business partner, he's everything I'm not. So I'm the streets and he's the brains kind of thing, or something like that. That's I don't really know.
I think that's called yin and yang.
Yeah, yin and yang. He definitely keeps the ball in the court for me. So,
when you guys launched this, when did you guys launch Good Company?
We launched it about just under 2 years. Okay. And, you know, it's been a huge success. Like, I couldn't even imagine the, you know, the strides we've taken. We're now in kegs. We're in 30-liter kegs and 50-liter kegs. We just launched 30-liter kegs as of today.
Which is really congratulations.
Exciting. Yeah, nice. Thanks. We're doing a 2-keg giveaway if you check out our Instagram.
I did. I saw that this morning, actually. Yeah.
Tag your favorite restaurant and they get a keg, and so do you.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Perfect. That's actually a really good
absolutely. Yeah.
Great way to get your beer out there.
Yeah. And under 2 years, believe it or not, Southern Glazers, one of the largest distributors in North America, just became our sales rep. So we just fully signed the contract last week, and it was kind of in the works for the last couple months. And, you know, they gave us a call and they're like, they love the way we're doing, and they saw our growth. They saw our growth potential, and they were like, wow, you know, Vancouver doesn't really have their own value craft brand. Yeah. And we definitely want to take you guys on, and we want to take you guys across Canada. So, it's quite impressive.
Well, you certainly, amazing. I mean, you definitely hit the market at the right time as well with that, because I've already seen a couple of copycats of you guys in the market, which is...
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, the copycats are pretty funny, because...
Can you name a few that you've
seen? Well, I'd rather not.
I'd rather not name them.
I want to see if I can put one of you on the spot, see if you guys can fall for it.
Tweedledee and Tweedledah Brewing over in La La Land. There's a couple, definitely a couple copycats out there. The best part about my position is that there's already been a couple craft brewers that are trying to come down with a value brand. Yeah. Now, the problem with that is that they're going to jeopardize their entire portfolio. Yeah. And I already know of one company that just tried to go to bat with us, and we're like small potatoes still, you know, and they totally threw the rest of their brands in the fire.
Isn't there
room? Wouldn't you say there's room in our market for as much craft beer as possible?
Yeah. I mean, yes and no, but I think if I'm understanding Petty right, I think what you're saying is them having a value brand devalues perhaps their craftiness.
Well, think about if, I'm not saying if Strange Trails came out with a $9 and don't you dare, but six pack, I feel like it would get away from your mandate.
Yeah.
And then what are you really doing? Like, you guys make amazing beer. Yeah. You know, it'd be like, okay, and here's our sidekick project.
Yeah. Right? Well, I think that's why typically a lot of bigger breweries or bigger craft breweries rename their value brand, right? Whether people know or not, they'll typically rename it so you don't necessarily think it's them.
Yeah, exactly.
So I actually, my most recent article that I wrote for Tracking Food, I wrote it, came out last week. I brought up the idea, and I was curious to think what you guys think about this, is the idea of market share compared with beer versus wine. So in the wine industry right now, you can find wines that are thousands of dollars or $300. You go to a restaurant, you can buy a wine that's $600. Do you think that the beer community has been admonished to this pricing plateau? Do you think you guys could ever get to a point where you could charge $70 for a six pack? Do you think people's perceptions of what beer could come to? If let's say you went out and you're brewmaster and you guys came up with, either one of you guys came up with a really, really detailed, nuanced, really unique, funky beer, and you guys had a price point that you felt like this is kind of like what Grey Goose did, you know, 20 years ago when they said, you know what, the top selling vodka in the market right now is $17. It's absolute. We're going to charge $30.
Well, didn't Storm Brewing do that with their Ice Bock?
Yeah.
Did you guys hear about this?
No, awesome. I didn't hear
about
the Mammoth Tooth or something.
The Mammoth Tooth is great. It was a triple.
What'd they do?
Ice Bock.
Was it $100 or maybe it might have been even more.
I didn't think it was $1,000. What they did was they took a.
They only had something 70 bottles.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, but it was ice box. So it'd been frozen and thawed just four or five times.
But that's one point. But the other thing was that they actually had artisanal blown glass bottle, and they filled the bottle and actually had a saber-toothed tiger tooth with an engraving in the bottle.
Yeah.
So each bottle was unique of its own.
Did they sell?
I mean, of course, it probably sold out. Like, I think most of them went to Bury Creek and Legacy, but I think they sold them all. I mean, that was, I want to say it was 2 years ago.
Those guys definitely sold out.
But I mean, that's more of a niche thing, right? I'm talking something that would be more consistent. You could find a day, you went into Legacy right now and you could find on the shelf a six pack for $90. And it was a certain beer with an iconic, you know.
I
Do you think people would go for it?
I struggle to think that it might work with cans. I mean, already, cans are great. Like, I prefer cans personally. I mean, for our big bottle program, because everything's bottle conditioned, that makes the most sense. Mm-hmm. But for your everyday crushable kind of beers, cans are great because they don't let any light. There's way less chance of oxidization and all that kind of jazz.
Yeah, because that's a big thing with big problem with beer bottles that are green. Am I correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm now coming out with a $100 six pack with virgin made with virgin tears.
But I think that the perception of cans in the market is still evolving. Like, I don't know that someone wants to pay that kind of price for something that comes in a tin. Yeah. So I could see that happening with bottles, and you kind of already are, maybe not quite to that extent, but I mean, I picked up a couple bottles of Burdick from Ontario the other day, and they were, you know, 30 plus bucks each.
Okay. So you definitely are seeing it.
Cascade Brewing down in Portland does like 42s.
Yeah. But don't forget, like,
Cascade in Washington,
those barrel aged beers and those, I mean, with our Reynard, I mean, it's barrel aged for a year and a half, and you think a lot about.
That's why it's so tasty.
That's why it's so delicious. But you think a lot about, like, that when you're trying to monetize that as a company. You think about the space that is, the time that is, and you try to put a price into it. There's more of this resemblance too, by the way. And we thought it might be kind of high in price point, but we tried to keep it as down as much as possible, because at the end of the day, you also don't want to price yourselves away from people trying the beer. I think a large part of what we do, though, is to try to elevate beer. You know, it's not just something crushable. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Like, crushability is great. Mm-hmm. I always joke that, you know, if someone tosses me a Coors Light on a golf course, I'm not going to say no. You know, a cold Coors Light with golf.
You mean
sun.
Good company lager.
Well, what's going on here?
Well, I don't need to be on a golf course for the big company. But there's also the
I've
other
seen
side
the way
of
you
beer.
Play.
But it's the other side of beer, you know, the elevation of beer that it can be paired with food just as well as wine, and sometimes better depending on the style.
The greatest
of food.
Acidity that comes from it.
Yeah. Well, that's my point, is that I think in our market, there's room for both. Obviously, both sides, which is very true. Yeah. But also, I think there's room, and I read your article. I read all your stuff, by the way.
Oh, thanks, buddy.
But I think what's an interesting point is that the markup of wine in the restaurant, right? Mm-hmm. So that's another interesting part, is that if you're at a nice place, like, you know, what's a nice place in Vancouver? I don't get up much.
St. Lawrence.
And you have the Reynard there or something like that. Yeah. Instead of being super close to what the actual store price is, there's a markup on that bottle because it is aged a year and a half, and you're paying, you know, instead of 16, you're paying like 32 or something like that.
I think that's a market that's totally missed, because I feel like the Reynard could be easily a beer that you could pour with a great pork chop or something like this at a steak in a restaurant, and you can be like, this is the sommelier or the beer sommelier, the Cicerone, whatever, has paired this with this, and they could mark it up for $60, and it's a beautiful and delicious, and it will pair very well with that food.
And there's definitely some restaurants that have been doing that. Really? Which is we've sold our bottles. I mean, Merchants comes to mind immediately.
They've done some of those things. I've seen those.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to be closing soon, so that's obviously the first in my mind, but there's been plenty of others. But I mean, Doug's beer list at Merchants is off the hook. There's rare and terrific beers. I mean, Nick Miller as well at Wildebeest has been doing an awesome job with the beer list there as well, with the big bottle stuff that you know maybe don't see in that caliber restaurant all that often.
They have all the Quebec stuff.
Yeah.
Tout le Diable and all
and
that
they have,
stuff.
And they have Reynard there, I believe.
Oh. It's going to be pretty hard to, like, you know, it's nice to see it's going in that direction, especially with the aged beers, but it's pretty hard to justify, you know, like, aged wine to aged beer.
Yeah.
Well, and especially when it's sitting in like storage and.
Yeah, I know.
France.
I mean, yeah, well, that's the thing, is right. I mean,
is it though?
With 100-year-old vines or 1,000-year-old vines, you know? Like,
he's a smiley. I don't ask him.
No, I'm just a wine snob. No, I just, for that's me, true. For me, I was just looking at the idea, because I think the beer community has really come so far over the last like 15, 20 years with the craft evolution.
Huge.
And I think people's perceptions of what beer has been for so many like decades and millennia is just cheap, drinkable, really simple. And I think a lot of people are making really, really great beers. And I think I wonder if people's perceptions are catching up with what the quality is.
It's not just nice quality, high old world wine that gets marked up. It's everything. It's shitty Mission Hill. It's everything. Yeah. If you're in an environment of a restaurant, you're paying for atmosphere, you're paying for service, you're paying for all this stuff.
Yep.
You know? Yeah, good company lager, you know?
Instead of
$5 a pint, it should be
$10
a pint.
A lot of restaurateurs forget when, you know, like, people come to your place because they want the experience. You know, when people come to the Boxcar, you're getting an experience, you know, like no other. And that's what we hope for. You know, you're not just a bar. You're just not a restaurant. You're just, you gotta create that experience for people, you know, whatever it is, right? So
can I just say as a side note that Boxcar has the best music in the city on a week day-to-day basis. Best music.
So if you guys don't know, Mick is he's kind of a big music nerd.
I'm a former DJ.
I'm a big music nerd too. That's cool.
Well, shout outs to my wife, Tadia. She curates all the music there. So
fantastic.
You know, and all the DJs.
It's also one of the coolest bars in the city.
Well, it's funny because I was there the other night.
Stop it, guys.
I was there a couple nights ago and I was.
Keep it up. We already got the t-shirt.
No, I hadn't been there since they'd reopened. I just hadn't had a chance, and I just had laser eye surgery, so I've been shut in here.
He did. Jamie can see now. That's awesome. Glasses.
Yes,
that's a slow round of applause for Jamie's eyes.
But I've I'm finally here.
I mean, I got to do that.
But I went in and I sat down, and I remember sitting with my buddies in the back, and I was just like, this fucking bar is so awesome. I think one of the things I love most about it is just it's tight, it's conformed, it's like kind of it's got this like kind of nice.
It's social.
Filter.
It almost reminds me of.
So I'm very happy you guys reopened.
Thank you. Almost reminds me of a communal, sort of a European communal style, where it's thin and you have to talk to people beside you because the space. It's just a very like sociable environment.
Well, it looks so cool in there.
When Ezra and I first took over the Cobalt, I was like, we made sure that. Like horse and carriageway that was going through the building. A lot of people don't know the history of the Boxcar, but like that old horse and carriageway was in our lease, knowing that that's going to make the coolest bar in Vancouver.
So you already had that fashion.
The minute we looked at the place, we're
that's
like,
amazing.
These guys are going to give us this space for free anyways. Like, let's put our red line right into it. And they gave it to us thinking like, what do you guys want tunnel for?
That takes amazing forethought to look at that carriageway and think it could be a bar. Because I remember when you guys told me you're going to do it, I was like, that's like a dingy, dark.
It was a smoke pit, essentially.
Yeah.
I remember that carriageway.
Like, yeah, it was scary to walk through.
Well, we actually rallied the neighbors because that was quite the camp out for a lot of individuals, and we rallied the neighbors, and you know, we wanted that thing shut, so all the neighbors kind of called City Hall and was like, backing us up to move our red line in it. So thanks to City Gate and everyone out there that helped called City Hall, and we got our red line moved in there and put the fence in the back and away we went.
That's awesome.
Hey, it's good. Now we just got to wait for the other one to come back up, but hopefully soon.
Yeah, we're waiting to see what happens there. They're doing renos in it right now. The way it's looking is that we're coming back in a year. But, you know, when it comes, you know, obviously I don't want to talk too much about the Sahotas, but, you know, when it comes to them, it's a crapshoot, man. It's like, you know, either way, you know, we got our lawyers on the sidelines just waiting. I got off the phone before I showed up here, talked to them and was like, listen, we got to sit down and have a meeting, you know, they're removing the floor, they're removing the washroom. So hopefully I get back within 8 months and there's going to be a brand new Cobalt.
Perfect.
So that's going to be pretty awesome. Exciting.
Yeah. And I feel like the city's going to rally with you guys. And I think it's going to be a very big,
absolutely,
you know, homecoming. And
yeah. We'll figure it out one way or another. If the Cobalt doesn't open up, we'll open up something bigger and better. 100%, without a doubt.
Love it. Absolutely.
Whether it's under the Good Company, you know, flagship live music venue and like event space, like look at the Cobalt, like look at all the things we've done. It's like Snag started there, you know. Look at the East Van Pride parties that we used to do there, Page with Man Up, you know, Queer Bash and those other parties.
Yeah.
And all the live music and Timber concerts and, you know, just the way live music is going in the Vancouver. There's a lot of back room deals being made within live music and it's going to get a little bit of a squeeze.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, MRG just bought Imperial.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Oh, it just got sold?
Yeah.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah. So MRG is like building their little monopoly stack here.
Are they keeping it as the Imperial? Or there? Okay.
Yeah.
As far as
just accumulating assets.
You know what they're doing, though? Is that they're taking over... this is just hearsay.
No one's
check my facts.
That's
Patty talking about it.
But, you know, they're taking over a lot of places and they're actually like, you know, telling people like Timber, like, beat it. We're going to start. So they're starting to steal a lot of shows from like Timber and like Live Nation. So all these other like Live Nation and Timber, they're like, they're scrambling to like lock down venues because MRG.
Well, we have no venues in the city now. I mean, there's like, we're losing them
Interesting.
Do you guys ever get approached with the American to do stuff?
We get approached to do American. Now, I'll get this out of the way. Like, you know, the American is a 250 person music, was a 250 person capacity room. The Cobalt was a 250 person capacity room. Now, those two were just duking it out for the same bands all the time. So it was, the American was a little bit of a business strategy to protect the live music at the Cobalt, because the Cobalt can handle more expensive bands.
Push one out and do the other.
Well, it was kind of like if the American and the Cobalt are both, or back then the Electric Owl, were both duking it out for the same bands. You know,
right across the street
from each other. It's a no brainer. You know, it's just bad business for both. So the American was there to protect the Cobalt for live music. And to be honest with you, the American can't really afford to do live music.
Yeah, no. You still have DJ events and stuff like that.
Well, it's just so how the lease is just.
Yeah.
And I think the Electric Owl proves that. So
yeah.
They lasted, what, 3 years? So
only 3 years, really?
Yeah, huh. It wasn't very long.
I'd be surprised if it was even less than that. They weren't around.
I don't even think they paid their rent for the last.
Half the time you go in there, like three quarters of their taps would be empty because I don't think that any of the beers.
They had an identity crisis, you know, like most bars do. You know, they wanted to do the food and the live music, which you got to pick one or the other.
Yeah.
You know, and they had a nice room, so, and then a beautiful kitchen. So I don't know what to say.
So if we were
doing okay.
We're doing all right. Yeah.
So if we were to talk about your guys' brands in the BC market right now, how do you guys look to grow the brand with such a, I wouldn't say saturated, but the market is growing and there's a lot of new breweries coming in and new styles of beers coming in. Do you find it challenging, or is this something you guys have to navigate, or is this something that, because you guys are some of the first, that you guys have already kind of weathered the storm? And like, I don't know, I'm kind of curious. Do you feel like the market, do you think some of these breweries are going to maybe shut down, or like, how do you guys feel the,
it's a good question.
I'm just curious. Cause I mean, like I think in the greater Vancouver area, I think there's like over 90.
Do you guys know what the stats are on craft beer versus big boys?
I think I don't.
What's the market share for a craft?
I think it's.
We have over 150 in BC right now, right?
Oh, 150 craft, but
their actual market,
the percentage? I think you guys are moving up in the 15%
somebody
now.
Somebody Google it.
I wouldn't call it that high.
That high?
I don't think so. No. I mean, the last time I looked at it was right before Strange Fellows was opening.
I think it was like 5% at that time.
Right? Yeah, it was nothing. At the end of the day, you get outside the city centers, and it's still, you know, people are still discovering craft,
but it's getting better.
Oh, it's certainly
hot spots. Like you go out to like Maple Ridge and like Abbotsford.
So how do you feel you move inwards? How do you get higher? Like as a emerging brand, how do you guys find?
It's no problem for Strange Fellows.
Yeah,
they got that talisman. They got the. Yeah. By the way,
do they even need a sales rep? I don't know.
Maybe I can use this form right now to have a referendum with Nick to make sure that the dark IPA is something that they make year round, because that is the greatest beer.
I'll bring you some white IPA.
Yeah, the Nocturnum is my favorite BC beer.
I thought you should try that.
Yes.
I was actually drinking that at Kids Fest.
Where did you pull that out of?
Oh, nice. Yeah, just on the street. It's amazing.
Nick just pulled a 4-pack out of his. I don't know. Where'd you pull that out of?
My magic beer bag.
Never ends.
Yeah, I think. To get back to the question, I think craft will continue to grow in the marketplace for sure. And you're right. I mean, there's so many breweries open up, and there's still going to be. It kind of, you know, at times I think of it as kind of restaurants in the late 90s, early 2000s in Vancouver. You know, it seemed like a lot of people that maybe didn't necessarily come from the restaurant background were keen to open restaurants in Vancouver because it was a booming kind of restaurant scene. I feel like that's happening with Vancouver right now as well, as people are seeing that there's an opportunity, whether they come from a beer background or not. Us at Strange Fellows came from a beer background, which I think is beneficial, because it can be a really, just like restaurants, it can be a really tough market to enter into if you're coming into it kind of brand new.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Oh, and we see a lot of those breweries around town.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
What would you say the percentage of high quality craft beer being brewed as opposed to low quality craft beer being brewed?
I
don't know if I could put that into a percentage, but one thing that's great about where craft beer is coming in Vancouver, because it's still, I mean, when I was with Red Truck when I first started in the beer industry. I was a bartender mostly a busser actually at Yale Town Brewing Company.
Oh, okay.
I was doing a couple day bar shifts here and there, but mostly a busser on Thursday, Friday, Saturdays. And I started with Red Truck as a delivery guy. And even back then, that was...
What year is this?
2000... I'm terrible at trying to remember years. A lot of beer drinking. 2005, I want to say. 2006, something like that. And I started with Red Truck. And even back then, you know, Sam Payne, who's really taught me most of everything I know when it comes to beer and sales.
They really had the market cornered, Red
Truck. He was doing such a great job with... Because there was only draft back then. And, you know, you go into restaurants and bars, and if they had eight taps...
you know, I six of them are going to be Molson or Bud, you know, depending who had the contract. Then there's maybe two others that would be Okanagan Springs, actually,
and
back
then. Maybe
then,
like Pilsner or Kell or something.
Big Rock was big back then.
Big Rock, yeah.
So a lot of Big Rock. And then big Sam Rock was big.
Where did, what happened to Big Rock?
They're still around.
They have a new brewery down on 2nd.
Olympic Village.
Yeah. Or sorry, 4th.
I bike by that one all the time.
So, I mean, that was just over 10 years ago. And to think of like how far we've come in that time, and I still think there's a lot of growth to be had. I think the one great thing about all these breweries, and there's so many of them that are making great beer. I mean, Lupulo just opened, and they're making some really outstanding beer.
I love their stuff.
They're great, and they're right down the street from
us. Off the rails, great.
Yeah. So I think a lot of those guys that are, you know, that are out there and are making terrific beer, it just keeps everybody on their toes. You know, like, there's no sitting back and resting on something. So, yeah, I mean, Talisman's are our flagship, and it's our biggest seller, but, we're still continuing to grow other stuff. And that's a big part of, like, the our big bottle stuff is to do unique, smaller, barrel-aged kind of.
Do you think that's important for a brand to be kind of successful, is to find one beer in your portfolio that's kind of like the stakeholder and then kind of build around that one?
One thing that we've certainly found with Talisman, I mean, I remember when I first tried it, it was about a month before we opened. Ian had brewed a batch and it ended up actually being a little bit lighter than it is now. It was like 3.5%. And it blew my mind. It was just like, man, this is amazing how much flavor this has for such low percentage. Yeah. And, you know, I do have a tendency to have a few beers if I'm going to have a beer. And it's nice that it's 4%, so you can and not act like an idiot.
Do you want to tell us what the secrets are to the recipe?
I have no idea. Ian's a bit of a genius. But yeah, I from the moment that I tried it, I was like, this is great and there's nothing out there like it. I think this could be a huge hit for us. So I think it's really helped get the Strangefellow's name out there. And it's certainly, you know, given that I think there was a bit of a gap in the marketplace for it, it's helped us to grow who Strangefellow's is. So to get to now when, you know, I find a lot of our bar manager partners, you know, will tell me that, you know, no matter what beer we have on tap, someone will say, oh, you have Strangefellow's, I'll just get that. So that's kind of nice. You know, I mean, I'm glad people are seeking out Talisman and that's great, but to get known for a quality product as well is pretty cool that people, you know, it doesn't even matter what beer of ours they happen to have, they know they're going to enjoy it, which is rad. I don't know if that answered your question at all.
I got lost in my own answer.
You know what I'm liking to see is like a lot of bars and restaurants are actually turning to like craft beer, like the ones that you wouldn't like expect. And people actually go, what's nice to see now is that people actually seek out bars and restaurants because of their beer list.
Yeah.
You know, because it's awesome.
A perfect example of that, sorry to cut you off, is Kraft in Olympic Village.
Yeah.
When they first opened, it was literally like every Phillips beer, every Labatt's beer, every like European like staple like Pilsner or Kell or like Brio.
There is such a thing as, you know, decision fatigue though.
Yeah.
You're like,
but now
craft is also like everyone's favorite place to go, but every like beer rep's nightmare.
They finally have now are supporting local craft breweries, which when I went there, the first three years ago, no, it was not. It was like the big boys and that's it. They didn't have anyone that was local.
Yeah.
But I just found out I banned it. Personally, I never went there, and I had a friend recently tell me, "No, they have beers from so many local breweries." Now.
They're doing a great job curating their list.
Like people finally getting the fact that this is a thing, and they should have.
How many beers do they have on top there?
150.
It's 100.
They have 150.
150. Yeah. I'm pretty sure.
How many good beers?
I used to bartend at the Alibi for a while, though. And I remember when I started there, as was after I left Yale Town.
Nigel needs a big round of applause.
He's been absolutely massive. He's been a huge part of my learning process.
Represent.
But I was bartending at the Alibi. And I remember Nigel had, I think, 22 taps when I first started there. And that includes the three beer engines. And about a year or so into that, he decided he was going to close and double that. So he's going to 44 taps. And I remember thinking, man, that's nuts. Because at the time, there was still quite a bit of American beer on his list. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
Legion
this is long enough ago that there weren't
like Washington and
Oregon enough kind of local Canadian breweries to fill those taps. So there's still, I think he still always had kind of four Belgian beers and then a bunch of American beer and then Canadian beer. I mean, Red Racer, Phillips, and Driftwood really like kind of the biggest, and Red Truck.
And Tree from Kelowna too, I think.
Have any of those companies been bought? Are they still independent?
I believe Tree got purchased.
Is
Red Racer still independent?
Yeah.
Damn.
But then, you know what? He was what, like 2 years probably? Maybe even less than that, about a year before a bunch more breweries, like 33 Acres were opening, Brass Neck were opening, and all of a sudden there's been even more. So now it's rare that you see American beer on their list necessarily, you know, maybe one or two every now and then, but it's definitely not the staple that it used to be, which is great. I mean, that just shows that the market in Vancouver is getting better and better, and the beer's getting better.
Well, not
only
that, but you have options now.
Yeah,
I think that's the precise.
Well, especially with the American dollar.
Yeah, getting
like
the beer.
Those kegs, so you want an American keg, you're looking at like $300, $320, $400.
For sometimes. A 30 liter.
For 20 liter.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's crazy the prices, and you know, where you get something local like a Strange Fellows is like $220.
And it's delicious, yeah.
But I mean, okay, so for you, Patrick, as of today, you were saying that you kegs are now available for you guys.
Yeah.
How are you guys going to be looking to get your kegs into the market?
Well,
because I mean, you guys are probably going to go for a different. Are you guys going to go for the same market?
No, we don't go for the same market. And you know, Good Company is not the same market. It is and it isn't. We kind of sit on the fence when it comes to everything. We're a local crushable craft beer lager. You know, our six packs are $8.69. We're going after this. We're going after the market where, you know, a guy goes into the liquor store, he buys a couple bombers of Strange Fellows, and you know, but he's going to a party and he needs a couple crushable beers.
Yeah,
that's not going to break the bank.
Yeah,
and that's what we are. Like, we're not trying to pull any quick ones on anyone, and that's just the way we are. There's positives and there's negatives to that for us. You know, we've really done really well with a lot of, believe it or not, high end restaurants in Vancouver. Like Cachillo, Labatoire, you know, all these awesome like places that are like,
yeah, and like
they have us in a can. It's like, quite impressive. Like, we actually thought we'd be more like the live music venues, but it's like the Diamonds and like the Diamond Cocktail House and all these places that have actually picked up. Like, we've now have over, I don't know, 250 accounts, like bars and restaurants. We're actually 90% bars and restaurants.
That's awesome.
And 250 accounts?
We have 200.
In 2 years.
Wow. Yeah, in 2 years. And, you know, 90% of them are bars and restaurants, and like, we're just trying to break into the cold beer and wine store.
Well, I just want to say, this is actually I'm drinking one right now, live. Well, we're not live.
It's not the first time you've had this, right?
It's the first time I've had one.
You've never had one?
Yeah, man. This is like super flavorful, like way more flavorful than Parallel 49's craft lager. Like, it's almost like a darker lager.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, we definitely added, you know, there's quite a bit of we actually have a little bit of a hint of Kolsch in there,
like,
to give
rich.
It a little bit. Yeah. To give it a little bit of a hybrid
stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and see, it's meant to go on the golf course, go fishing, or whatever the case may be.
Oh, fantastic. What did you just crack there?
I just cracked the second resemblance, but it's a bit of a gusher. Yeah. I hope you guys don't mind my lips on your beer.
It's a lively fucker.
And it's only 12:30.
Yeah. Okay, well, as we'll let Nick pour some beer here right now. I guess I have some ideas that I was curious about.
It's the same one?
It's the older version.
Older version? I just want to say the first one, I got candied apricot bubblegum. Is that accurate?
I would say that's somewhat accurate.
Yeah. Bubblegum butt smash.
It's a little full of shit.
Syringes. Yeah, bubblegum. He's fan.
Also, you mentioned your collaboration with Modern Times. I personally feel that Modern Times is one of the preeminent breweries in all of North America. How did that come about?
Where's Modern
that
Times?
Collaboration? San Diego. Their beers are fucking unbelievable.
Because is that the brewery that you keep talking about?
That's
the one you're talking about.
Yeah, I heard some weird rumor that they have.
Okay, so I guess you just asked the question, but I was going to say, how did that come about?
Yeah, just keep up. Jamie.
They were. I want to say they're still fairly new, just like us.
They're new. Yeah.
Almost the same age as us, I want to say. I mean, they've grown quite a bit. I mean, that's the difference of opening up in Southern California as opposed to Western Canada. You know, they're directly available to 30 million people immediately.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little bit different marketplace, but they've certainly grown quite a bit bigger. I think they've got two or three rooms in California and San Diego, and then I think they have two rooms in Portland as well, breweries and tasting rooms. But yeah, the guys that distribute them up here, a friend of ours reached out to us because they were making a trip up here and asked if we want to do a collaboration with them. And we're like, yeah, absolutely. So the guys came by, really good dudes. They brought the yeast culture, I believe. Don't quote me on that because I sell the beer.
That's actually what I wanted to ask.
Hold on,
I heard that they have...
Can you bring that across the border?
I heard they have...
Can you bring anything else across the border?
Yeah. Actually, I've got a... we'll talk about that after. But sorry, go ahead.
Off record. They formulated some sort of special hybrid. It's not liquid yeast. It's not powdered yeast. It's like their own special concoction, which makes their beers have these like three-tiered flavor profiles and like this really big taste.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That I do not know about.
Do they have a, do they have a signature beer that they're like known for?
Their Fortunate Island, which is a hopped wheat beer. A sessionable hopped wheat beer is amazing. And they have one called the Oneida or Onadia, which is like a sort of a amber ale. It's really good. All their beers are fantastic. I can't say enough about them. I haven't had a beer from them that's not good.
Where do you guys get your hops from? You guys get your Cascadian hops?
We have a few different hop providers, yeah, but I believe Hops Connect.
Was it Cascade? Okay.
Yeah, Cascade, yeah.
I think
Cascade.
Hops Connect might be the biggest contract we have.
Okay.
I feel like Hops Connect. I could be wrong about that.
Do you guys feel like people are, I think you brought this up a little bit earlier. Do you think when kind of the craft beer scene took off, it was people like, I think Patrick said this is like everyone's trying to figure out like, I want to develop like the next, you know, Blue Buck or the next really, you know, Fat Dog. Do you think people are starting to kind of turn on the IPA world and they want something different? Or do you think?
I don't think so. I mean, I always equate kind of people's taste for beer similar to my own discovery of beer. I mean, when I first started at Yale Town, I mean, that's how I met our brewmaster, Ian Hill. He was the brewmaster at Yale Town Brewing Company. So I would manage that liquor store during the day and bus at night. And I'd hang out with him a lot during the day at the liquor store. And he taught me so much about beer. And before meeting him, I was really drinking nothing but Stella or Guinness. And then he kind of blew my mind with all these beers he was making. Reynard back then was just called the Oud Brown. Mm-hmm. And I remember trying that and just being like, yeah, flabbergasted that beer could really taste like that. And I really enjoyed all of Ian's beers. And the process that I went through was kind of like, okay, realizing that beer can be more than just a lager. You know, for me, before working there, the only IPA I'd had was Keith's IPA. Which
that's not even an IPA.
It's kind of, it tastes more like a lager or light ale of some kind.
Were there any things around at that time where either the Deschutes, Smear Pond, and then Sierra Nevada? But those are the only beers that I was exposed to around that time that had a hop content.
I remember that, like the American beers made a huge push up here.
Rogue was big up here too, right?
Yeah, oh my God, what is this taste?
Yeah. There was such a huge hard on, and you know, rightfully so, there's such a huge hard on for American beers.
Yeah.
And then I think they just got outpriced out of the market.
Well, I think we make amazing beer here.
Donnelly actually was one of the first places I remember that actually carried that stuff.
Yeah,
yeah.
In the city.
Well, yeah, I remember I was actually working for the Donnellys back in the day when they decided to make the whole like Belgian beer push and like just like let's get like you know well, 20 yeah, let's get 12 stuff. Beers on tap and it was great. You know, they aligned themselves with the Labatt, but Labatt back then had a and they still do have a pretty sweet, you know, Belgian portfolio, obviously, because, you know, they're owned by a Belgian company or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I think when you think of Canadian beer in Vancouver, Vancouver-based kind of craft breweries, you need to tip your hat to you know, Steamworks and Yale Town when they opened those brew pubs.
Yes.
Because that was like 94. And, you know, they were finally starting to make you know, those closer to those quality beers. I mean, and that was the first proper IPA I'd had was at Yale Town Brewing Company. And I didn't know an IPA could taste like that. And that's, I think.
Was Vancouver even ready for an IPA back then?
Well, honestly, when I was bartending, I used to warn people, you know, people would be like, oh, I'll have an IPA. And I'm like, it's not Keith's. Yeah. And they're like, yeah, I know. I'm going to get it. I'm like, okay. Like, Two seconds later, it comes back and they're like, I want a lager. That's an IPA. And I'm like, God, I knew it was going to happen.
It's weird that I find people that I don't like when I meet people who don't like IPAs, I find it weird because I love them so much. Yeah. But I think what it is, I love so much of that acidity that comes from it.
Totally.
But the bitterness is why I think throws people off because they're just not used to it.
And especially back then, I mean, when I was working there, there's still like the Northwest IPA was still kind of a less fruity, you know, these days, especially like the hazy IPAs or like the white IPA.
There you go.
Is a juicier kind of flavor, and the Talisman even with its hop character is more fruity, which is it's certainly super approachable. But I remember when I first tried IPAs, I was blown away by the flavor, and I really really dug them.
Yeah.
And I went through my major IPA phase, and then you start to discover all this other stuff, whether it's Belgian beer, whether it's different porters and stouts or saisons. And I feel like everyone goes through that kind of process. I don't think IPAs will ever go anywhere. I think there's a reason why people want an IPA because you want to quench that flavor. But I feel like people do go through a progression where it's IPAs only, you know, for a while because nothing is going to scratch that itch, that bitter, juicy itch that you have. It's got to be an IPA.
I'm definitely on that one right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because for the longest time, my whole drinking career, I only started drinking when I was 24, which is ironic in itself. I'm a bartender.
Weird.
But,
and you're only 26.
Yes. It's only 2 years.
Yeah.
No, but when I first started drinking, I thought the coolest thing in the world to drink was Jack and Coke. And then I realized that was stupid. And then I got into wine and then I became a sommelier. But then I realized as you go through your sommelier training, the last thing you want to do is drink wine when you're done. So I started getting, and the beer that I loved for the longest time was Guinness.
Yeah.
And I still love Guinness.
But
now, like if you go in my fridge right now, I have no Guinness and it's like IPAs or like bigger beers. And my friends always make fun of me. Like, oh, we'll go to the beach. And like, dude, like, how are you going to drink six IPAs?
Yeah,
no doubt.
Yeah, it's like, you know what's funny?
What do you mean?
No problem.
Yeah.
Do you guys sometimes find if you go into a certain room, the certain room dictates what you're going to drink?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like when I go to the Granville room, I drink Guinness.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, every time I go to Granville room, I'm like, give me a Guinness. Like, why not?
Well, because so few places we go to these days still have Guinness on tap.
Lamplighter was like that for me. Guinness. Every time, because I'd always finish work at Chowinston and we'd head over there and I'd always get a Guinness.
Yeah.
Or when I go down to Gilt & Co., I always get something dark. But I definitely agree with you.
Rooms definitely dictate what you drink, I find.
Maybe it's because it's so dark and danky in there. Yeah. It just like, has that like industry.
Well, Mammy Taylor's, I always go for a Talisman. That's a pretty dark room.
Yeah.
Well,
where's this?
Mammy Taylor's.
Ron's got that dark humor too.
Yeah.
So I think they work together.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, Patrick, with the American and Cobalt, did you feel, or even and Boxcar, did you feel like your clients or your guests gravitate towards certain beers, or like have you noticed that with what you guys sell?
Well, this is exactly what I was talking about earlier. Like,
can you guys change the taps often, or do you find like people?
Well,
just
we change the taps. You know, we have at the Boxcar we have 24 beers on tap, and we change the beers all the time. Obviously, we have our staples. You know, our Phillips or Strange Fellows and all the other things. But we love to give the little guys a chance. You know, the Lupulo and yada yada. Like,
you guys have the darkness there, which not the darkness, the dark matter, which I love.
Yeah, and don't forget the Cobalt. When when we were open, like we were the first place to have Brass Neck on tap. Actually, we were the only place to have Brass Neck, a live music venue. If you wanted Brass Neck outside of the Brass Neck Brewery, you came to the Cobalt to catch a show.
Yeah,
and believe it or not, like having our
craft beer, we have a special relationship with Nigel's, right?
Yeah, so. Exactly. You know, the special relationship. But yeah, like it was when we sold tickets for shows, like guys from, Live Nations or whatever, they were telling us that they sold an extra 50 tickets just by having at the Cobalt, and people knew they can come to the Cobalt
and get breasted
and have craft beer. And we're probably still the only like craft beer live music venue in the city.
Do you guys feel like that's a big missed opportunity with Rogers Arena and the BC Stadium? Because I just saw recently.
They
signed that big contract with Budweiser, and don't you think that? Well, like I got frustrated because when I read that, I was just like, why are they not supporting the locals?
No, they have craft beer. They have Goose Island.
But why are they not local? Well, like, why wouldn't they support?
It could be the touch of death for a lot of craft beers.
Like handling that volume.
Well,
or you just instantly become uncool.
Okay, let's talk about craft beer nerds.
Oh yeah,
let's talk about those guys.
Nick, have you met any craft beer nerds?
Nick knows all of them. Check out his Grindr profile. It's something to be said. I don't even know if we should be talking about this one brewery. But anyways, there was back in the day, these guys landed their craft brewer, a largest contract. I'll let you guys dig for it if you guys want to look for it.
I know you guys know what I'm talking about.
And it was the money. It was the Ebuchadnezzar of deals. And I would take it in a second. I think, I'm not sure. But man, did the craft beer community ever turn on them?
Yeah.
It was like, I don't even know why. It was like,
there were so many articles in the Growler about this exact situation.
I wrote an article exactly on this point about a year ago, and it was touching on this with Laboratoire and how some person had commented that I'd gone there and they said that place is pretentious.
What place is this?
Laboratoire.
Okay.
And what I wrote back, and I wrote a whole column on his rebuttal, and what I wrote about was the idea that you can be cool, but if you become too cool, then people rail against you. Yeah. And it's this weird thing. I termed it with Coldplay, because Coldplay was like really cool when they came out, and then they got really, really big. And then people,
on this podcast.
No, but they were like
slap you across the table.
No, but
I feel the exact same way, man.
But you gotta listen to my point. But they were like this cool little indie band, and then all of a sudden they blew up and they became U2. And all the people that loved them, that they were, because they were like this cute small indie band with their first album Parachutes, they all of a sudden became like the favorite band by like everyone's mother. And so everybody who loved the fact that they were like my cool little secret, because I'm the 17-year-old teenager, was like, why is my mom, my 40-year-old mom loves this band now? I can't like them anymore.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's kind of probably what you're touching on here, is like, this brewery was cool, and all of a sudden now my dad drinks them. And I can't drink beer my dad drinks.
And our goal is never to deny our beer to people because it's not a cool restaurant or it's not whatever. I mean, my opinion, I would really like to get people to try the beers as much as possible. I mean, I think that should be really the goal of any craft brewery is you make something that you want people to try. You want people to enjoy the product that we make. Like, I know I certainly do.
Has to have integrity, right?
Yeah, yeah.
When you get to the point where your production outweighs your quality of product, and that's when
that's an issue. I mean, and that's certainly an issue. But I mean, we sell beer to Rogers, and I mean, we're only on it at the one craft beer bar.
Are you really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, and
$20 a pint,
and you know what?
That's how expensive it is.
and that's great because honestly, I love the Canucks, and any chance I get to go to a Canucks game, it makes me happy that I can have a Strangefellows beer. I mean, given the fact that it's only at one bar, I know. Not everyone, no matter where you're sitting, like me, will trek to that bar every intermission.
It's like the restaurant, right? Upstairs?
It's down at the bottom. It's like 101 or 123 or whatever. Okay. Bar Jones.
Bar Jones. Good. If you're at a Canucks game
that's the unofficial name, I should say.
Go to that place and get a Strangefellows.
Yeah.
Do not get a Coors Light.
Nick Black likes the Canucks and Jamie likes Coldplay.
That's what I'm taking away from this podcast.
That's going to be the byline of this episode.
No, he used to like Coldplay before they got cool.
Yeah, his mom started listening to it.
I should clarify, I love the Canucks.
You guys should actually read the column because when I wrote it, I was just like, it was my ex-girlfriend's mom loved it. And I was just like, did she start playing? I was like, I can't like this band anymore. I was like, all right. I was like, and then I told my brother, and he's like, "Why did you like that band in the first place?" And I was just like, "All right, now
Dave knows what he's talking about."
Just to get back to beer nerds,
shout out to Dave.
You know, shout out to the beer nerds for supporting the community and everything, and giving everyone a chance. But I like to start seeing these are hometown heroes. You know, like this.
Absolutely, well, that's what I'm saying.
And like, let's build this brand up because it's like, let's get this going.
Well, I would. Absolutely. I mean, these are. I would say that to a certain extent that's there. I mean, if you look at what Driftwood has done, I mean, they produce great product and they're continuing to grow every year. And, you know, it's rare if I've ever heard anyone say anything bad about them. They cannot, like, maybe I'm patting ourselves too much on the back, but I consider Talisman kind of like the Fat Tug of pale ales. Fat Tug came out, was such a huge success. And rightly so. I mean,
it's a delicious beer.
At the hotel right now, we pour Talisman and Fat Tug, they're right next to each other.
That's awesome. Yeah, and Fat Tug is such a great IPA. And actually, all of Driftwood beers, they make outstanding beer. And I think it's great that, they, for the most part, from what I understand, is they haven't, as you say, Petty, been turned on. They, people for the most part celebrate them, which is great.
Can I just tell a quick little anecdote? So I was serving a guest about a month and a half at a bar I work at, which is a hotel at an airport. And we have the Fat Tug IPA on tap. And he is like a really big IPA nerd. And he lives in New Jersey. So he sat down at the bar. We're just having a chit-chat. And he looks at the tap and he goes, "Is that Driftwood Fat Tug IPA?" I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "Oh, you guys have it on tap?" I'm like, "Yeah, the brewery's on Vancouver Island." And he goes, "Let me show you this." So 1 week before, he was at a liquor store in New Jersey. And he takes pictures of all the beers, his favorite beers. So he had just snapped a picture of the Fat Tug IPA and goes, had this one like 4 days ago in New Jersey.
That's
like,
awesome.
Wow, it made it all the way to the East Coast. I was like, wow.
They're all over the states now.
I didn't know that.
I want to say 15 or 16 states.
Wow.
Do you guys want to go to the United States? Either one of you? Have you guys had
of course I want to go to the States.
Well, I know you do.
Yeah, I'd love a vacation.
Yes. Am I allowed?
Donald Trump?
Well, it's crazy. It's crazy to think, you cross the border and you go to Seattle and all of a sudden your market is like 10 times bigger than Vancouver. It's like, but then again,
your
you're
competition
like,
is
everything. Yeah. Your competition is so much bigger. But then again, you go to, if you're going to invest some money into somewhere, do you go back east to Toronto and say this is a beer from Vancouver, or do you go across the pond into Beijing, where you have 30 million people? It's like strategic. Like, what do you do? Because everything costs money, right? And every company's always strapped.
How do you guys navigate that? Like, how do you guys navigate keeping the brand strong where you live, but also having a vision for like, okay, I'm sure you guys sit down with your partners and go, okay, we're going to plan strategically for the next year, for the next 2 years, for the next 5 years, this is where we want the brand to grow. How do you not stretch yourself too far, but also how do you like envision thing? Okay, we're going to put this amount of resources into building the brand in this market. And do you, like, how do you know when like, Like, do you ever feel like a point where like, okay, we're going to go into this market? Do you, is there a point where you're like, okay, if we don't hit this certain target in that market, we're going to pull out? Or is it something that you're like, we're going, we're going to make it happen, and it's just like...
Well, can you stomach it?
Can you stomach it? Yeah.
Can like, can you stomach the ups and downs? You know, good company loggers, we're not exactly the biggest team. Like, if you look at... You look at what we do, it's like, it's me, Mike, we got one sales rep, Bren. You know, my wife does the social media. We're a small, tight team. And then we contract brew at, right now, three different breweries. And that's what we do. You know, like, there's no, we're small, the smallest team. We're probably the smallest team out there.
Specifically for the volume you're doing.
And for the volume,
the volume that we're doing, yeah. Which is insanity. But at the end of the day, you know, the company was bootstrapped. Actually, Mike and I started the company at kind of like, hey, let's roll the dice. Let's see what happens and let's make this happen. And all of a sudden, boom, 100 accounts just showed up and we sold out. And then we released some more and we sold out even more. And it was just like our first year, we sold 120 pallets of beer.
It's awesome.
Which is unheard of for a startup for
it's
one.
Fucking awesome.
In, for beers in cans. You know, so
how
instantly.
How much of that sold at the co-op?
Nine. The cobalt's a strong account of mine. It's strong. It, you know what? The cobalt, I'll tell you exactly what the cobalt sold. The cobalt sold out of the 120 pallets, sold about 20 of those pallets.
That's pretty awesome.
You should write one of those how to start a small beer company for dummies.
With no money. But like you said, it's just like, can you stomach, because we're bootstrapping the company and we don't have a financial backing. And now that we signed up with Southern Glazers, which is amazing, you know, so we got a little bit of like, we got 9,000, you know, staff now all of a sudden out of nowhere that just started repping our beers across North America. Now the question is, how do we move forward and can we like enter those markets?
Yeah, like how do you keep that momentum going?
Well, baby steps for us, because we, you know, we got to take these little baby steps and not mess it up, because you can't be running out of beer everywhere. So you can only like, we're in Alberta now. We're going to be looking at Toronto.
Are you going to eventually be making beer in those provinces?
We're already looking at Alberta.
Because I know the provinces just had a meeting last week where they're going to be talking about how beer is going to be crossing the borders a lot more freely. I'm sure you guys probably read about this.
I've heard about it, but you know what?
I mean, obviously, this is all speculative. I don't know if it's actually going to happen, but is that something? Is that a problem, getting beer across the borders for you guys? Is that a difficult thing?
Within Canada?
Yeah.
No. It's easy. The only problem is that you got one chance.
Like if you wanted to get into the LCBO in Ontario. Is that hard?
That's a different game. But I mean, we've only gone as far as, well.
I found you in Saskatoon.
Yeah, I was going to say as far as Alberta, and then I found out that some of that product ended up
I was in Saskatoon with my brother. I was there back in April, and we were in a little like small little beer liquor store, and I saw his beer.
Yeah.
The Talisman?
Yeah, I sent him a picture. No, it was the Talisman.
It was Bayard and Coup de Food, which was a... Yeah, Bombers. A couple of Bombers. And then that was really, when we did that, that was kind of the test of, one, what we can handle and what the market out there is looking like. And that came, you know, an acquaintance of ours and a good friend of mine does distribution in Alberta and Saskatchewan. So he's, you know, he said, I think your beer could do well out there. At the time, half of our thought processing was that, you know, we didn't have the can stock to be able to ship too many cans. So we started with the bottles to see kind of what the reaction would be, and then in the future to do cans will certainly be something that we do as we grow. But it's definitely been back to the question, it's definitely been a conscious effort on our parts not to ever grow so big that we can't supply the promises we've made. So I mean, right from the get-go, when we first had cans, we limited ourselves just to private liquor stores. No government stores could get the product, just because we didn't want to run out. I mean, the worst thought is to have an empty tap or a dry shelf, because in my opinion, you may not get that space back again.
Yeah, and then and restaurants will drop you so quickly.
And I'm not going to lie about this. We've actually run into this at the hotel a few times where we've had beer and the company will call us and be like, we can't fill the order.
Yeah.
And my boss and I will just be like, next.
Yeah. Well, next. There's enough options now that, you know.
We've actually had some breweries where we've wanted to deal with them. And they've kind of given us the cold shoulder, and then coming to us later on, and then we're like, nope, it's like we have enough options now that we don't need to do that.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, I've certainly, unfortunately, I've certainly had to say no to people just at times when we haven't had the stock, and with the thought that, you know, this was when we were younger. So let's say we're a year old and there's a new company that wants to bring in our product. But I know that we just can't actually sustain that. You say, like, right now, unfortunately.
But that's smart though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's the way we tried to grow. And we're at a point now where our production is great. You know, we don't have a fear of running out and we're selling enough beer. So it's pretty even right now. So now is the time that we'll start thinking about kind of moving further and further away. I always think of it, and this is something Jim Dodds used to say to me at Red Truck, is thinking from the brewery just to circle out. That makes the most sense for your growth.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we're still getting further and further afield in BC and just continuing to grow that circle. Now, as far as down south goes, I would love to be able to go on a trip to Portland or something and find a Talisman in a store. I think that would, it's the same, you know, kind of euphoria I feel going to a Canuck game and being able to grab a Strange Fellows. You know, that would be really cool. You know, I'd
definitely a feather in the cap.
Yeah, it's neat. You know. But yeah, what that looks like for the future for us, you know, we don't have any necessary plans right now immediately to be going south, but it is something that's neat. I mean, I used to do US sales for Red Truck back in the day when we were going to Bellingham, and it was just small. It's just starting in Bellingham, and I'd go down and do a trip down there every 2 weeks and bring kegs in the truck. And Bellingham has got an awesome, awesome beer culture. And
absolutely.
And, yeah, it's a really cool little town.
It's crazy how much
town.
Cheaper Canadian beer is in the States than in BC.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, because of taxes.
Yeah. It's crazy. Anytime now, price is going to go up for pints. You know, where are you looking at? What is it, like $8 for a sleeve is pretty standard?
Well, the minimum wage going up.
Is that
going
to affect you? Is that something you guys worry about, stuff like that? Like, I mean, especially with your tasting room and stuff like that, like, you know, minimum wage going up. Does that affect pricing for you guys?
Yeah, it did. Yeah. Not, I wouldn't say a huge amount, but you certainly have to sit and look at it. You know, you have to look at the numbers and who's coming in and be like, I know a successful restaurant, you know, I don't want to say big chain, but a small chain that's got multiple locations, you know, they had to put it up across the board. And it just makes sense because, you know, your cost, especially for a restaurant that's got 40, 50 staff, your cost just skyrocketed, mm-hmm. just went up quite a bit, just that small little bunch. So yeah, as a brewery, we didn't change it much, but there was a slight increase, and that's just, it's kind of like, you know, I went to Cardam's, I think, and they had a note up for the first month after, just saying, you know, you will see a slight increase. I think it was 10 or 15 cents for a cup of coffee, just to make way for the minimum wage increase.
Crazy backlash.
Yeah.
Well, you look at it this way, like in the next 3 years, you know, no matter how you like slice it, but these are just the facts, like. You know, your labor cost is going to go by 50% at mm-hmm. every bar. And that's it. And typically labor costs sit around 30% at a bar and restaurant. So all of a sudden now it's like you got to make up for that.
Well, we had Ron Oliver here from Amy Taylor's on the podcast on our third episode. And we talked about that with him in the sense that, like,
yeah,
minimum wage,
to that one is good.
Yeah, minimum wage is going to go up to, thank you.
Shout out to Ron, friend of the show.
Minimum wage is going to go up to 15-20 by, what, 2021 or something like this. And he was even saying, he's like, you know, as a small restaurant owner and someone who wants to put out an amazing product, he's just like, you know, this is going to change possibly my business plan, because it's going to force me to have to maybe make some decisions on certain things. And I know it's going to obviously reflect in pricing. And, you know, I think a lot of restaurants or everyone's going to have to do that. You know, like when minimum wage goes from $11.65 to $15.20 in 3 years, that's a huge jump.
And if you're surviving off minimum wage, you're not coming to the bars and restaurants anymore.
Well, exactly.
Like,
so,
at the end of the day.
No.
Fair. That's fair.
You know, like if you're surviving off $9 an hour and you're going to $15 an hour, you're not being like, wow, I just have an extra $40 to spend. Let's go blow it at the Fairmont and have a cocktail.
One cocktail.
Yeah. No tip.
Have a Louis cocktail.
Yeah.
Where do you guys see the market being in 10 years? Do you guys have any
forecasts? An interesting perspective here, guys. I'm gonna lay it on it. Okay.
I'll go second, Petty.
Okay. I think with minimum wage going up, and I think what's going to happen is that once a lot of leases come up for renewal, for commercial leases, I think a lot of bars and restaurants are going to feel the pinch. You know, I feel, especially all these like mom and pop places that are just hanging on by a thread, are going to go under.
We kind of need that, actually. The city has over 3,500 restaurants. We have way too many. And there's a lot of restaurants in the city that are, like you said, if you're just barely making it, sorry. I mean, like, your business plan is clearly not working. And I don't want anyone to lose their business. I want people to thrive in whatever they want to do in life. But there's way too much of that in our city. The problem with our city is we have no market here. There's no business here. Our market is real estate and tourism. And outside of that, anything, the only other thing that people can do in the city is hospitality.
Well, that or if you work for social housing.
Yeah, social housing.
Like that's a business of its own.
But I mean, like I think it's like you said, people are going to feel a pinch big time.
Totally going to feel a pinch.
What it's going to do is it's going to change the business. You're going to have a lot more jukes. You're going to have a lot more takeout service. You're going to have a lot more of the Taco Fino where it's going to be stand-up burrito service.
It'll be just drones delivering.
And you're going to have a lot less of the, the actual service. And you're going to have a lot less people in the kitchen. You know, it's going to be a lot, things are going to be a lot more streamlined. And it's going to cause people to want to be more innovative, which is a good thing. But I mean, they're going to have to be. You know, and it's going to change the demographics of this market. But
well, you know, I feel like there's going to be a lot of open commercial real estate. The question is,
who's going to take it?
Well, what kind of toll is that going to have on actual real estate, like home real estate? You know, like if no one can lease the bottom floor,
who's going to want to live there?
Who's going to want to buy it?
You guys see that as an opportunity? Maybe. Do you think some people are going to see that as an opportunity?
There's going to be, well, obviously, there's, you know, after the forest fire, there's always an opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, for a guy like me, yeah, bring it on.
Well, I mean,
and it's great.
Absolutely. I mean, especially if you look at the people that have been successful in the hospitality in general, right? I think there's always opportunity. The people that can make it with multiple locations. I mean, it's tough enough to make it with one location. But if you think of, you know, like the guys that do the Poorhouse and St. Lawrence and like, you know, they have a few restaurants now that are all doing really great. So I think it's opportunity for some of those guys to continue to grow. And people like Patty. I mean, Patty's got a few different restaurants.
Patty, would you ever do another beer?
Well, would I do a build off of Good Company or would I do another thing on my own?
Or whatever.
I don't think I'd want to mess with Good Company. I think Good Company is a standalone product.
Okay.
What if I did anything with Good Company? I would tweak the product.
Okay.
And always try to make it bigger or better. I think there's a lot of room to grow there. Like I think that just in general, the juice, you can always get better. Like, why not, right? Regarding Good Company, you know, why mess with a good thing? You know, maybe we'll do a collabo here and there. Maybe a Rattler and maybe like a Good Company Smooth for a lighter beer. But I don't know if the market is ready for that. And to be honest with you, we're not ready for that.
Would you ever want to do like a more like kind of what Nick's doing over like Strange Falls? Kind of a craft style brewery? Is that something that's ever
maybe not now, maybe in the future. Maybe if you know someone goes bankrupt and I can pick up a brewery for 20 cents on a dollar. Yeah, sure. Let's
just wait 10 years.
Hopefully not.
Nick, you want to come work with me?
It won't be strange.
I think he's wanting you to make some bad moves coming up.
Yeah. Invest here, Nick. One of those. But you know, I might get into the spirit world. I'm playing with the spirit world. I'm not going to say what. But definitely recreate the formula with Good Company in the spirit world.
Would you guys ever do a tasting room?
Not a tasting room, but what we do is more of a, like a live music venue. Oh. So yeah, like it would be like a multi-purpose room kind of space. So there'd be an art gallery, shared space, workspace, definitely a live music venue, just like something like that. And I think it would be where I was talking to you before. It was like with Good Company, you know, for us, it's more about the Good Company experience. You know, we want to make sure that when you come to our live music venue, you know, you get the full treatment. You get the Strange Fellows beer. You can get all kinds of beer at a Good Company, live music theater or whatever the case may be. But also there's an art gallery. There's a smaller space that you can rent out or whatever the case may be. That's more what I'm more into. For me, I can, with the amount of breweries that are out there that are just looking to brew for anyone because they have space, I'll take those all day long. Here's a contract. No problem. For me, I'd rather, if I'm going to drop $1 million onto something, it'd be more of a, let's have something like crazy.
Awesome. I think it's great. I think Vancouver definitely needs something like that. And I think all of us would put our hands up.
Vancouver needs way more of this kind of stuff.
Indoor skate park in the Good Company, like warehouse.
Love it.
How awesome would that be?
Who wouldn't love that?
Vancouver's becoming less no fun.
I'll tell you this. I know a ton of small, good friends who have these great up-and-coming bands. If you need some music and stuff like that, it would always...
Well, talk about no fun. You know, like try opening up a restaurant or bar in the city. It's like the city's
it's
got
like a common theme in our podcast. Yeah,
you can't even get liquor primary right now, right? You can't get one.
No, you can get a liquor primary. Liquor primaries are not a problem to get outside the downtown east side. So there's a moratorium on the downtown side. So there's no like.
So that's basically from what Gastown all the way up to commercial.
Go on the city website, check it out. Pretty much goes from all the way from if I remember. Victory Square, all the way to Clark Street, from where the Cobalt is, or Hawthorne Park,
all the way to the water.
Okay.
All the way to the waterfront. And there's a stranglehold here. And, you know, that's really unfortunate for the city. And I feel like the city is completely missing a great opportunity here because this is the cheapest rent in town. This is prime time. And instead of, like, harnessing live music and all the things that are awesome in Vancouver, they're like, no, screw it. We're not having any part of it. You know, do your fun things other places. Yeah. Like,
outside of the city.
Yeah, go ahead. Let's open up like an awesome nightclub in Kitsilano. Yeah, let's see how that goes.
Yeah.
Where everyone's trying to sleep at 10:30.
Yeah. Okay. Well, gentlemen, this has been great. I have one thing I'll ask you. What's the one thing, Nick, that people wouldn't know about like working with beer, working in a brewery that you would say is like kind of unique to what you guys get to do? Something
great,
fun.
That was a great opportunity for a joke, but I won't.
Yeah.
I was going to say brewers are interesting individuals, but I won't say that. I don't know. I mean, it's one thing people don't know. I mean, it's probably the thing that everyone knows the most is just it's a great industry to have a good time in. Huh. I think people that take themselves or take the industry too seriously can lose the point of it. And I think that's the biggest part.
Delicious beer.
Just making delicious beer and you know, and trying to have the best time while doing it and celebrating that beer, you know, celebrating whether it's ours, whether it's other people's. I mean, anytime I'm out in the world, I was talking about grabbing the Burdock beer. Anytime I'm out in the world, I like to grab other beer and see what's out there, see what other people are doing. I mean, it's kind of like with being in the restaurant industry. Yeah. You love going to restaurants and see what everyone else is doing. It keeps you on your toes with what you're doing. I think that's the part I like about it the most is just being passionate about what we're doing, but having a good time doing it.
And it's a great community.
I've
had a chance to meet, you know, a couple of the guys from Parkside and you guys and Nigel. And I mean, you guys will all really pull for each other.
Yeah, it's an outstanding community. You know, I'd like to think that we're all pretty good friends and
nice.
And challenge each other and enjoy what each other do as well.
Yeah, like if you're trying to be stuck up and like keep to your own, you're going to fall apart.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like there's no room for that in Vancouver.
But before we go, I'd like it if you guys want to plug anything. Do you guys do anything coming up this summer? Do you have any events or anything you guys want to talk about? Brewing the Beast is next week. Are you guys involved with that?
That's just Phillips.
Is that just Phillips?
That's their Phillips event.
Who's that?
Who's Phillips?
We have Joy Fest happening. When do you guys usually like a week later you release?
Yeah, it's be up in about a week.
Is that
or so?
A secret that I probably shouldn't say?
No. Go ahead. We usually record and then it's usually up a week later.
All right. Well,
yeah, this will be up about a week.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, we have a fundraiser this Friday, but I guess that won't apply next week. But August 11th is Joy Fest, where we shut down our parking lot and have a bunch of beer, live music. We have four different bands. Dennis Brock from the Revelers is gonna be playing. I don't know if you guys have been to the Revel Room on a Wednesday night, but man, it's one of my favorite.
I have actually.
It's a blast. It's some really great music, and we have three other bands with them playing.
You guys are part of Skookum, right?
We are going to be a part of Skookum. Yep.
Awesome. That's exciting. That's coming up too. I mean, Skookum Festival. Anybody doesn't know about it? It's coming up in Vancouver, Stanley Park, early September, and I think it's the Killers and the War on Drugs and Florence and the Machine. You guys have a big. Yeah, I think it's going to be a pretty big.
Yeah, I think we're one of six breweries that are going to be there. As far as the craft tent goes, I mean, there's the overarching supplier, which I think is Okanagan Springs, but we're part of the craft tent. But yeah, Joy Fest is at the brewery itself in the parking lot on August 11th at 2.
Patrick, you guys got anything?
Yeah, definitely. Potentially doing a big party Oktoberfest at the late September at the Hastings Racetrack. That's going to be pretty fun.
Okay.
Strange Fellows is going to be involved in that. Same with Railtown Cafe. We're still in like the planning stages to see if it can work out. That's pretty exciting. And, you know, we're really stoked to be working with Southern Glazers. So that's your Bacardi and Patron reps. And if you want to get a hold of us, just give your local rep a call.
And kegs are available now.
Kegs, 50s and 60s. 50s and 30s.
Yeah. All right, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks anybody for the out t-shirts.
There? Thanks so much for having me. Sorry I didn't have t-shirts.
Patrick went up to you on that one.
Next time, Nick Black Park 2, I'll bring t-shirts.
Yeah.
So you can find
I'll bring kegs.
You can find Strange Fellows Brewery up on Clark Drive. Check out their website at strangefellows.com. I'm assuming.
Strange Fellows Brewing, yeah.
Strangefellowsbrewing.com.
If anyone listening hasn't actually tried the beer from Strange Fellows, please, for the love of God, do yourself a favor.
The Talisman is their signature. I love the white IPA, the dark IPA, the Oud Brunum. Fantastic brewery. Great tasting room. And Patrick, it's a good company, lager.
Correct.
.com.
Yeah, awesome. Lager.com. Yep. Find us online.
Yeah, find them online. You can probably find their cans anywhere in the city. And gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having us.
do check out the Track and Food website. We are on Medium. You can find my writing on there. I'll have a new article up probably in the next week or so. I'm going to be starting a new series. My last one was just finished off the Perception series. I talked about beer and pricing and its perception with wine. If you haven't had a chance, check that out. Also, this podcast, we are found on iTunes and Stitcher. Please subscribe to us and rate us if you've enjoyed today's episode. And do check out our previous episodes. And have a good day. Bye.
Cheers.
Cheers.